Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk about a brilliant book, a real kind of game changer in the study of journalism and war. The First Casualty by Philip Knightley, the war correspondent as hero, propagandist and mythmaker. Philip Knightley sadly died earlier this year. And I corresponded with him briefly over his biography of Kim Philby. He was a very nice guy and happy to answer all questions. And if you ever get a chance to read read the book, read Kim Philby, KGB Master Spy by Philip Knightley. It's a cracking and very, very interesting and revealing read. But the first casualty is a really, really insightful and interesting and well-researched book. And it's the kind of book that you kind of sort of history, exploration, written by a journalist, that often comes to think from things from a slightly different intellectual perspective than anything written by a historian. But the bit I want to talk about today is the practice of war reporting during the First World War, something that Knightley is extremely critical of. He says basically that particularly British journalists were guilty of horrendous distortions and dishonesty, and they masked the truth of the war quite successfully. Now, how valid a critique this is, I'm not sure. When it came to enforcing conscription in 1916, an issue promoted by the Daily Mail, a kind of a moral panic of an entirely unnecessary nature, the problem that the British Army had was it still was oversubscribed by volunteers. There was actually very little need to introduce conscription, which brings down Asquith government. So there are two ways to look at that fact. Either the British Army was successful in portraying the war as a successful, nay, enjoyable experience for the working classes, or, as seems probably more likely, the horrors of and the trenches had filtered through to British society by 1916, as you would imagine, after 2 years of heavy fighting. And young men were still happy to sign up, believing it either part of their patriotic duty or part of a wider adventure that they were going to have, or part of a struggle for civilization that they believed themselves to be engaged in. In 1914, journalism about the troubles on the continent that were brewing was fairly thin on the ground in Great Britain. As Philip Knightley points out, Britain's attention was focused on the possibility of revolution in Ireland, and the crisis brought about by the possibility of the Third Home Rule Act. The condition of particularly English thinking for the previous two decades had been that of splendid isolation, though obviously there had been ententes with France and Russia in 1904 and 1908. And the isolationist tendency of British public life, the British press, and the political classes was against being dragged into European war. Lord Rothschild wrote to the Times city editor and claimed that the newspaper was hounding the country into war. Free churches across Wales passed a anti-war resolution, and the Manchester Guardian, now the Guardian newspaper, carried an advert, a full-page advert, announcing the formation of a new league to stop the war, and the this resulted in an anti-war demonstration in Trafalgar Square. We have evidence across the country, this broad coalition of church leaders, civic leaders such as mayors and other dignitaries, businessmen, writing to the newspapers to keep Britain out of the war, signing manifestos. The Manchester Guardian, the Labour leader, the Daily News, and significant figures in the Labour movement, Ramsay MacDonald, Keir Hardie, the novelist Thomas Hardie, all protested and said that the war was going to be a disaster and was nothing to do with Great Britain. The cabinet declares war in opposition to this culture. Now, if you want to kind of imagine what this must have been like, think about the and stop the war coalitions that have existed in the past 10 to 15 years, where you've had public demonstrations, newspaper petitions, significant members of the political classes and the media classes, even celebrities, saying that the war will do no good and will be a catastrophe and is unjust and wrong. And then you have those who changed their attitude. I mean, a good example during the war is Rudyard Kipling, who was a cheerleader for war in 1914. He ridiculed the men who didn't sign up. He wrote an article, The New Army in Training, in 1915, where he said, "This much we can realise, even though we are so close to it, the old safe instinct savours from triumph and exultation. But what will be the position in years to come of the young man who's deliberately elected to outcast himself from this all-embracing brotherhood? What of his family, and above all, what of his descendants, when the books have been closed and the last balance struck of sacrifice and sorrow in every hamlet, village, parish, suburb, city, shire, district, province and dominion throughout the empire? Essentially, what will happen when young men miss the opportunity of glory?" Well, sadly for Kipling, his son John was killed in September 1915, and following that, Kipling began to refer to the war as a lie. He wrote a very poignant poem, My Boy Jack, in 1916. And the great line that he has is, "If any question why we died, tell them because our fathers lied." Now, in 1914, the British Expeditionary Force is a small, highly professionalised force, but it is something in the order of 75,000 men. It's not a fighting force that can contend with vast volunteer armies on the continent. And without the wholehearted approval of much of the country, the services of the British Army were going to have significant problems. And one of the difficulties that Philip Knightley points out is that Germany had never really been thought as of as a traditional enemy of Great Britain. Far more regularly, that enemy was seen as France and or Russia, the two powers that Great Britain is allied with. So drumming up a new anti-German fear and loathing was a pivotal task for journalists and propagandists. And Britain, by the end of the war, had created the most effective propaganda machine in the world. It was surpassed bar none. And it became the model for every regime, democratic and repressive, throughout the 20th century to adhere to. So successful was it. The popular perception of the First World War in Great Britain, that it was a war for civilization. The idea that it was a war being fought for democracy, this is not an idea that was popular amongst the troops. The term was not referred to. There's virtually no evidence that people were writing home saying, "I'm fighting for democracy." Democracy, it was not a given in Great Britain anyway. 40% of the working classes couldn't vote. Women were only given the vote in 1918 and then fully the full franchise in 1928. So it was not a struggle for democratic ideas, and it only really becomes thought of in those terms when the Russian Revolution, the February Revolution, happens and America joins the war by April 1917. Politicians like Lloyd George attempt to recast the war as some kind of struggle for democracy and freedom, whereas it certainly has never been thought of in such terms. The reason why it's consistently seen as a struggle for civilization, if you read Robert Fisk's amazing book, The Great War for Civilization, which is about the Western conquest of the Middle East in the 20th century. The reason why it's called the Great War for Civilization is it's named after his father's service medal, on which is written, his father served in on the Western Front, was written the Great War for Civilization. So civilization was a constant propagandist theme because the Germans were cast as being the enemies of civilization, the barbarians, the Hun, the Bosch. And the irony here really is that firstly, the Germans did very little in the First World War that was particularly more savage or violent than anybody else. And that Germany itself was a highly advanced, highly civilised nation with arguably greater levels of provisions such as social security than any of her enemies, and it was a font of science, learning, enlightenment and culture up to 1914. The Germans make a number of key propaganda blunders when they capture Edith Cavell, the British nurse who had been helping Allied soldiers escape. She was a British nurse captured in Brussels, and they execute her in 1915 as a spy. This kind of rather clumsy way of dealing with the issue plays directly into British hands, and you know the idea of the evil Germans murdering nurses becomes a kind of a rallying cry for kind of revenge.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
She had freely confessed to helping Allied servicemen and knew that this was an act punishable by death. Not that this justifies what happened to her at all, but the representation of Edith Cavell's execution by the Germans is was used in propagandistic terms by the British. The French had already shot one woman for doing exactly the same thing and were to, throughout the rest of the war, shoot another 8 for basically the same offence by the end of it. And the Daily Mail, of course, stepped in to help out with the representation or misrepresentation of Germany. On the 22nd of September 1914, the Daily Mail succeeded in referring to the Kaiser as a lunatic, a barbarian, a madman, a monster, a modern Judas, and a criminal monarch. The Germans were portrayed as sort of a monstrous horde. They are very often demonised as kind of apes, as rapers of nuns, bayonetters of babies, burners of churches, destroyers of civilization, and an ancient anxiety about the horde from the east. Which normally, and this was the suggestion that they were something kind of Asiatic, which obviously the German nation certainly isn't, helped to portray Germany as some kind of threat to Christendom. But you know, one really has to go back about 500 years for Christendom to exist as a kind of a united entity, and B, for it to be threatened by hordes from the east, normally being Mongols or the armies of Islam, completely and utterly different from Germany. It doesn't stop really it being a kind of like a powerful, emotional, unconscious sort of meme. Andrew Bonar Law, who was the colonial secretary, told an American correspondent that it is as well to have British patriotism properly stirred by German frightfulness. And Lord Northcliffe, the proprietor of various newspapers, including the Mail, said, "The Allies must never be tired of insisting that they were the victims of a deliberate aggression." The Fabian intellectual H.G. Wells, not a figure of the right by any stretch of the imagination, said that the war was inevitable because of the wickedness of Germany. But after that war would spring a lasting peace. And this led him to coin the phrase, "the war that will end war," or "the war to end all wars," which should kind of hang around his neck like a millstone, because he would later live to see the next war. Atrocity stories followed German actions. The invasion of Belgium led to the deaths of about 5,000 civilians. The French press carried a daily list of les atrocités allemandes, or German atrocities, and the British press joined in, and much of it is fabricated. The reality being that much of it didn't have to be fabricated, that the death of 5,000 civilians is actually bad enough, but the fantastical nature of some of the propaganda reporting we would find laughable. But it's always instructive to look back at some of the things that were said about 9/11, the Iraq War, etc., etc., and you find examples approaching the levels of absurdity as you find now, as you find in 1914, 1915. The Financial News, for example, reported that the Kaiser had ordered German airmen to attack King Albert of Belgium's children and to try to see if they could bomb them, and that double rewards were paid to German submarine crews for sinking ships carrying women and children. and that the Kaiser had personally ordered the torturing of three-year-old children, and had listed the tortures that needed to be inflicted. However, the Norddeutsche Allgemeine Zeitung in December 1914 had said that Gurkha troops and Sikh troops that had come to fight for the British Empire liked to sneak across Allied lines at night to slit German throats and drink their blood. German press obviously using as much kind of racist fantasy and vitriol to frighten the German population as possible. The German army did not have any colonial troops to fall back on, except for those fighting in Africa. And so this was a good bit of leverage that the German press could utilise. And it wasn't just journalists who were helping to disseminate these sort of fantasy stories. A committee of lawyers and historians under the leadership of Lord Bryce, who had been the ambassador to the US, created a report, and this was translated into 30 languages and disseminated worldwide, showing that British propaganda was mindful of bringing all of world opinion on side. And this said that the German army had systematically, not sort of randomly, but as a kind of a purpose, murdered, outraged and violated innocent men, women and children in Belgium. Murder, lust and pillage, the report said, prevailed over many parts of Belgium on a scale unparalleled in any war between civilised nations during the last three centuries. Again, the atrocities themselves had happened, but the need to exaggerate them actually tells you a lot about the propaganda war that was being waged against Germany. It was only after the war that it emerged that the Bryce Committee had not interviewed a single witness. The report was based on 1,200 depositions. Most of these came from Belgian refugees. These depositions were taken by 22 barristers across Great Britain. None of the witnesses had to go on oath. Their names were not included to prevent reprisals against their relatives. And hearsay evidence was accepted at face value. And none of the depositions were ever filed with the Home Office and have, to this day, never been uncovered. The Belgian Commission of Inquiry in 1922 failed to corroborate any of the most significant allegations in the Rice Report. Civilization and its defence comes back as a major theme, and the churches were able to endorse the war because they could legitimately say that civilization was under threat. The fact that Germany was two-thirds Calvinist and Lutheran and one-third Catholic, and it was as devout a Christian nation in Europe as it was possible to come across, it doesn't really fit into this narrative and so is ignored. And this war in defence of civilization that had become that had previously been an irrelevance to the British had swiftly been turned into a grand crusade and a struggle for civilization by the greatest world civilization in the eyes of British people in 1914, i.e. the British Empire, which obviously, as far as they were concerned, brought the light of reason and enlightenment to the undeveloped races. And this was now the one bulwark against a terrible, murderous evil spreading across the continent. The reality, of course, was extremely contrary to this. But the shaping of the narrative of the defence of civilization is one of the key devices for galvanising not just British, but imperial forces worldwide. And as the scope of the war grew, the initial mechanisms for disseminating propaganda which was a small parliamentary committee, the Parliamentary War Aims Committee, and a small press bureau, expanded into a government department. The Department for Information, which finally becomes the Ministry of Information, which was headed by Lord Beaverbrook, who again would be an important ally to Churchill during the Second World War, the Ministry of Aircraft Supply. Beaverbrook, of course, being a newspaper magnate and skilled in controlling the flows of information. And the propaganda effort was also aided by the Defence of the Realm Act. The Defence of the Realm Act was the most powerful piece of state censorship that has been ever introduced in Great Britain, and aspects of it still linger in things like the Official Secrets Act. And newspaper editors, far from being those who spoke truth to power during the war, were men who were ideally co-opted by power and who cooperated neatly. Editors of The Times, The Express, The Daily Mail, The Evening Post and The Chronicle, and the managing director of Reuters all worked with the government to disseminate helpful ideas. And the talent that they brought was an ability, as they had honed in the newspaper business, to articulate particular perspectives and points of view to, quote-unquote, the man on the street, and how to speak to his fears, hopes, enthusiasms, prejudices and outlooks. Now, tomorrow I'm going to talk a bit more about this and look at what some of the war correspondents in the on the field, people such as the great Wickham Steed, managed to report and omit. So tune in and we'll have a chat about that. I've launched a Patreon page. I'm really there with this 21st century social media funding type thing. So if you enjoy these podcasts and you would like to sponsor with for a meagre stipend every month, that would be greatly appreciated, and then we can really start to roll out more content for you guys. Anyway, look forward to catching you on the next Explaining History podcast, and I'll no doubt speak to you all soon. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.